are listening to a brand new season of Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. And I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California. And our mission is to shape college-aged people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will accompany our Tuesday night gatherings. And we hope that they form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. So, you know, back when we used to be able to go to other people's homes, how every house had a different smell. It's like it's the same air that exists at your house, but it has an entirely different and unique smell. And you wonder, what's creating that smell? What factors are coming together to create this olfactory sensation? Well, I am not a scientist, so I have no answers for you, but it's got to be the byproduct of just the way life is lived in that house, right? But it ends up permeating everything. And I bring that up because this episode, the first of this new school year, is going to try to answer the question, why does the college life house smell the way that it does? What are some of the realities that make college life what it is, that give it the feel that it has, that give it the identity that it has, and that end up both intentionally and unintentionally permeating everything in the house? You know, often those sorts of foundational features can be hard to define or hard to parse. But in this episode, we're going to try to do that. And we're going to try to be explicit, to be clear about some of the core ideas and beliefs about God and about human beings and about communities and about this time in college that ends up giving college life its distinctive smell or feel. And so here is the basic idea, is that we are obsessed with who you are becoming. And we are convinced that human beings become more like the communities that they're embedded in. So then, the very important question put before you is, which community am I going to embed myself into? And how will that community contribute to who I am becoming? It's a basic idea that you will see we have many thoughts on. And so we hope that they're helpful. We hope that they're intriguing. And we hope, more than anything, that we'll get to meet some of you who might be listening to this for the first time very soon. And if you are intrigued and want to explore more ways of getting connected with College Life, just visit our website, collegelifedavis.com, and you'll find a way to tell us who you are, as well as events and small group information. But for now, enjoy the pod. All right, everybody, welcome back. This is an exciting morning. Your pod and your staff is back in your ears, and we're talking on the microphones, and I am joined this morning with my good friend, Stanford Gibson, Dr. Stanford Gibson. Good morning, Stanford.
Morning, Peter.
The air quality is bad outside, but we are inside and we are ready for a high quality conversation. I realized I went back and looked, and the last time we were talking on the podcast was June 5th.
That seems
like a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then I did no research on this. I just tried to think about what has happened since June 5th. And there's been lots of bad things that do not need to be litigated here. So I decided to focus on some good things that have happened since June 5th. But an entire baseball season has been played since June 5th, I'm pretty sure, minus the postseason. And the problem with the baseball season is I don't think one person has watched one game of the Major League Baseball season.
Well, the Red Sox were so bad.
Yeah, they were.
I actually, less than not paying attention, I actively tried not to pay attention.
Tried to avoid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you put the blinders on. That makes sense. College life has pivoted in a bunch of different ways, which is exciting, you know, but we've gone online. So that's cool. That's happened since June 5th. We said goodbye to Miriam, which is sad.
Yes.
We have said hello to Maddie Peterson as a staff member, though, which is exciting.
Super exciting.
Super exciting. And then there's been all sorts of exciting things, which if you're a new listener is going to mean basically nothing to you. But Nathan and Tabitha got engaged since June 5th, and Paul Mutz got engaged since June 5th, and Charlie and Haley got married since June 5th, and Christian and Olivia got married since June 5th. So there's lots of good things that have happened in the world since the last time we talked.
Lots of good things since June 5th.
So if those names mean very little to you, then have no fear. That just means you're probably new to this community, which is one of the things you're most excited about for this particular podcast, is that we're hoping for new ears to be hearing what we're saying and to be joining in on these kinds of conversations. So it's great to be talking to you, even though this is sort of a one-sided conversation. We hope to see you soon. But so my name is Peter. If you're listening to this, you've probably heard my voice at other points and seen my face throughout the week on Zoom. But I'm talking with Stanford Gibson, which we just mentioned, and he is one of the bright spots in the world. And so he has been caring for college students and loving college students and attempting to help shape college students for a long time now, and is one of the bright gifts of my life. But he has many degrees, which I will not bore you with now, because it's unbecoming if I'm just looking at Stanford to just list all of the things he's accomplished. So I won't do that. But he is Dr. Gibson. And so he's had some formal training in scientific areas. And I think I will say this on Tuesday night, and I don't care. I think I'll just say it again and again, because it's the main thing I just keep thinking as we're approaching this new year. And I want especially new people to hear this, but also people who are not new, who have done college before. But I think that you all doing this right now in this season, I think that you are so brave. And that's the same, that word keeps coming to mind. And I don't know if it's the perfect word, but I just keep thinking you are so brave to take on this challenge, because we were freshmen once, which we'll talk about, but we were not freshmen in a situation like this. And there's a certain sense of course, there's many challenges, and those ought not to be taken lightly. But I am just so impressed with how many people are saying yes to these challenges, with how many people are diving in, trying to get connected online, and how hard that must be. And I just keep thinking they're going to make a movie about you someday. And so you better be thinking about who's going to play you. And it's just a remarkable story. And I can't wait to sort of hear the fruit that comes out of it. I know there will be probably a lot of pain and hurt in the season two, but also I think God will meet people here. And again, I'm just so impressed. And I just want you to know that. I don't know if that matters to you, but if you're wondering, is anyone seeing how hard this is? I just want you to know that you are seen. And I couldn't be more honored to be getting to walk through the season with you. And so that just needed to be said, I think. And again, hope to meet many of you soon. But I thought it'd be fun to relive our freshman year experiences and what it was like coming into college, because it's such a profound time. And it's one of those times where, do you ever have those moments in your life where like there's some sense, whether it's olfactory or whether it's auditory, that gets heightened? And so it's like if you hear a song from that season, it just takes you right back. Or if you smell a smell from that season, it just takes you right back. I feel like those happen in really heightened seasons. And so like the memories are sort of thick. And so it's not going to be hard to remember my freshman year, just because it was so profound. And so anyway, do you have anything you'd like to say about freshman year Stanford?
Yeah, you know, yesterday I was out with my kids and someone revved up a motorcycle and they had Smells Like Teen Spirit like blaring from their Harley, which is, you know, that's just, there's a yeah. little bit of an incongruity right there. But it immediately right. took me back to a basketball court in college, right? Like that mixture of sound, I was transported to my school. And I think that, you know, for me, it's been a little bit longer than it has been for you. As far as the listeners can't kind of see the age difference, but it's there. But the thing that surprises me about my freshman year of college is there's still some of the most vivid memories I have. They don't fade, because, you know, memory gets imprinted based on the intensity of the emotion that's one of the reasons why studying with a crush actually helps you maintain material, right? Yeah. Like that's actually a good study strategy.
So flirt to convert is a strategy for evangelism, but flirt to pass your classes as an academic strategy.
My wife and I, we studied together through all of junior year, and I retained that material much better. But you know, the memory is imprinted emotionally, not just you know, information. And so I think that the intensity of freshman year. And so I was a late high school convert. I didn't grow up in a practicing Christian family. And so, you know, I had this kind of brand new Christian faith coming into college, and it was frankly, I was concerned that, you know, I was going to a state school. I grew up in New York, so it's a New York state school. And, you know, I just heard that, you know, college is a really hostile place to the Christian faith. That's the narrative I'd heard. And so I just showed up kind of scared. And like, it's really kind of a caricature at this point, like 18-year-old me. But I literally went out and bought a bag of Bibles. A bag of Bibles. That's right. I went to like the Christian bookstore in my town and I just bought all of the like $6 Bibles that I could get. And I
was was that to pass out to people, or was that in case you lost one, you needed another one?
I'm like, I was gonna go and like put these Bibles in people's hands. That was gonna be like, I was gonna be the only Christian on this campus, I was sure. And so like, I didn't know what equipment I needed. So I went and got a bag of Bibles. Because that's, I don't know what every college freshman needs. Yeah. And so I show up at this like scary, you know, secular place. And we literally pull up to the curb and there's upperclassmen that kind of show up to help move you in. We were in residential dorms freshman year. And this young woman, she's a senior in college, a biology major. She picks up my bag of Bibles to carry it up to my room. And she looks in and she looks up at me and she's like, she didn't say this, but like she said something like, "This is a bag of Bibles."
Yeah. Are you aware that you have a bag of Bibles?
Yeah, bag of Bibles. Yeah. But it turns out that she was one of the leaders of the Christian community there on campus. And so she invited me to their kind of like leaders kickoff meeting that night. And I became part of the Christian community from the like literally the first minute I stepped on campus.
Yeah.
I didn't need to go like rogue with my bag of Bibles. I immediately had mentors. I immediately had a community. I immediately had people looking out for my formation, people who were interested in how my studies were going to unfold in the context of, you know, mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual development.
Yeah.
And so I became part of that community literally the first minute I stepped on that campus. And it honestly is one of the most important things that has happened, which is, again, I think one of the reasons why, like, as a, you know, whatever age class you want to put me in, let's talk about this in generations. As a, like, you know, Xer, college students coming in are a couple of generations removed from X. I still really care about how you're experiencing this moment right now, because I think it does set the trajectory for your life.
And I think we'll talk more about that particular idea too. Of one thing that also sort of keeps us coming back to this, and just again, it's always interesting because the decisions made here and the relationships and the formation here are not, don't just stay here. They sort of set you up for the next step, which is sort of the rest of your life. And so it's sort of thrilling. Right. I mean, it's like, it's on one level, it's so fun. It's like constantly so fun with college students, but it's also the stakes are high, you know, and which is why I think we care so much about what we're going to be talking about today. But go ahead.
So, Peter, my family was sitting on the couch the other day reading our bedtime story, which they've gotten more sophisticated as my kids have gotten older.
A bag of Bibles.
Yeah, right. Alethea, my middle child, turned to me and just out of the blue, she said, "Was Peter a student when you met him, or was he a pastor?"
Sweet.
Yeah, because they have memories of you going back like almost a decade now. But they were confused about the timeline again because they were infants. But the truth is that no, you were a student. I met you your freshman year, and I actually met you like not the first day of your freshman year. Why don't you tell us? You know, you had a different experience of your freshman year at college.
Yeah, I did. I think I had a very strange combination of sort of like radical fear about college and also an unfounded arrogance about about who I was. And so let me try to unpack what I mean by that. So my first second on campus was basically like me hugging my mom in just an ungushing tears of I didn't want to go to college. I thought high school was it. I thought high school was the best it got. I thought there's no way. I just didn't know the mechanics of making friends. I just thought, I don't understand how this is going to happen. And I don't understand how you form relationships ex nihilo, you know, how they just out of nothing, supposed to form friendships. I just didn't get it. And that just terrified me. And so I was very, very, very nervous and sort of kept to myself for a lot of the first couple quarters. And I remember there were days where I wouldn't speak to someone, and that it just would depress me, you know. And I don't know if I want to use that word because I know that there's actual symptoms and things that come from that word, but I was just down and I was just lonely. And at the same time, I was sort of checking out college fellowships. And I remember the first time I went to College Life, it was probably winter quarter at some point. I became a Christian in middle school, and then I was just really involved in the youth group, you know, I was really involved in the leadership. And so by the time I got to a senior, I sort of felt like I'm sort of like youth group all-star, you know?
You lettered in youth.
It was my letterman jacket, which is a cross. But I showed up and people were super kind and super welcoming. And I remember thinking, bro, like you don't know who I am, but like, I know what you're doing. You know, I know that you're just welcoming me because it's the right thing to do. And you don't know that I don't need to be welcomed like this, you know? And so there was this like unbelievable arrogance that I don't even know where that comes from, really. But so I really resisted getting connected for a really long time. And there, I would just show up late. I would leave early. And all the while probably thinking, maybe this place isn't for me. When in reality, like, did I really give it a chance? You know, that kind of thing. But there's one story around that time, I think it was in sort of February, that I would like to share that really encapsulates my freshman year experience. And I've told this before, but maybe people weren't around, maybe people don't remember it, but it's interesting. So there's, I'm a Coen Brothers movie fan, which you are not, Stanford.
Yeah, this is one of our strange differences.
Heidi Rudvogts, who's going to be editing this podcast, I think is a Coen Brothers movies fan. So sort of technically two versus one right now. Fair. But anyway, there was a movie out by the Coen Brothers called A Serious Man. And I was in the habit of going to see movies alone in my freshman year. Like, my dorm mates would all go out and have fun together. And I was like, it was a Friday night. And I just was sort of resistant to making friends or connecting. Something was off. And so I opted not to go hang out with people, but to go see A Serious Man by myself. And so my plan was always, I would go to Chipotle, I would get my burrito bowl, I would stick it in the sweatshirt pocket, and I would sneak it in to the theater. And so that was my plan. So I go to Chipotle and get my stuff. I put it in the sweatshirt pocket and I'm on my way. And something that you should know if you're new to this town is that there's two movie theaters.
That's right.
And they're both Regal movie theaters. And one is on F Street and one is on G Street. They're on literally adjacent streets. And
don't try to park at either of them on Friday night.
Terrible. And so you look at Fandango and you look at the movie times, and it's hard to, especially if you don't know which ones they are, it's hard to distinguish which one is which one. And so I just go to one of them and I buy a ticket and I am sitting in there. I walk into the movie theater and, you know, obviously I get away with my scheme of bringing in Chipotle. They didn't pat me down.
You're very clever.
Yeah, very clever. And so I'm sitting in there and no one else is in the theater. So it is me alone on a Friday night, and this movie starts to roll and Colin Firth is on the screen. And if you IMDb this really fast, Colin Firth is not in A Serious Man.
No.
Colin Firth is
Colin Firth has never been in a Coen Brothers movie.
No, I don't think he ever will be. Very, very, very charming fellow, Colin Firth, though.
For sure. But not a Coen
Brothers kind of guy.
He doesn't put people in wheelchairs or things like that.
No. Yeah. And so I get a little bit confused. I look at sort of my ticket, and it appears that at the same time that a movie called A Serious Man was playing at the F Street Theater, there was a movie called A Single Man starring Colin Firth, which is playing at the G Street Theater, to which I erroneously showed up to and bought a ticket. And so here I am in the wrong theater, sitting alone, watching a movie called A Single Man. And it was just it was just this meta experience of what it's like, I guess, when you are struggling to connect, and how I was struggling to connect. And this is like pre getting connected to college life days, but it was a pretty funny experience, you know. And so I sat through the movie, and it was fine. It was okay. But I still have never seen A Serious Man by the Coen brothers. So that was my freshman experience. It was very, for the most part, it was very lonely. Looking back, I think I was probably sort of on the fence of whether I was going to really own my spiritual life, you know, if I was going to dive in and take it seriously. I think all the evidence points at it wasn't super important to me at the time. You know, it didn't matter to me too much to get involved. My single Bible, not bag of Bibles, was gathering a lot of dust. And so it wasn't until I finally went on a spring retreat with College Life, and I kind of said, okay, this is it. Like, if this goes well, I'm in. You know, if this doesn't go well, I might be out. So, and then obviously here I am now, still in College Life, leading it now. So freshman year matters, and also it can be very difficult. I remember when I was going on like orientation tours and stuff for different colleges. I remember at one college, they said that college is the best 3.5 years of your life. And that first half of the first year can be pretty tough. And there is light at the end of the tunnel. So anyway,
I think that one of the things that strikes me about that story is that it seems incongruous that you get dropped into this place that has 35,000 people that are like designed to be your friends. They're like in your cohort. They couldn't be more close to you culturally, even though there's a lot of diversity, and yet you still feel lonely. Mm-hmm. And that can actually feel like personal failure, but it's actually just like part of the experience, right? Like it's actually, navigating that is kind of the task of those first 3 months.
The fact that if you see three faces that you know from College Life or from whatever community you're in, like in the coho, it just makes this huge campus feel so much smaller. And it's amazing how different it can feel, how different the same space can feel in the matter of a few months. So what is interesting about particularly my story, but maybe a little bit yours too, is that, you know, if you've heard a little bit about what we've been teaching in College Life so far, and we'll talk more about it right now, but you know that a lot of what we focus on is formation, like who you are becoming and how you will be once you sort of graduate and sort of getting plugged into a community that is going to care about your formation and care about who you're becoming and set you up for the next few decades. And what's interesting about both of our stories, I think, is that neither of us were necessary. And again, I'll just speak for myself, but I don't think I was looking for that. I think the things that mattered to me were like, can I belong here? Will they care for me? Will they love me? Will there be a place for me? There wasn't much who's going to care about my formation. You know, do you feel like that's accurate to your experience? Or
Yeah, that's right. Like, I just didn't understand how people develop. I come from an immigrant family, and so academics was really stressed. And I was thinking about, am I going to make it? I was a physics major, and I failed my first test. There was just all this academic anxiety. I wasn't thinking about, what kind of person am I going to be in 4 years? I was thinking about, am I going to still be a science major, or, you know, am I going to make it? And from the context of like my faith, it was really just, is it going to survive? Am I still going to be a Christian in 4 years? It wasn't, what kind of person is God going to form me into in the context of, you know, academic curiosity and spiritual growth and community? And those weren't the sorts of things that were on my mind.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think there was much sort of anxiety about school for me, and not because I thought I was so good. I just wonder if I didn't care enough, honestly, right? You know, but then just sort of at the beginning. And I'm trying to think about what really mattered to me was, yeah, sorts of those questions of, am I going to belong? Are people going to know me? Will I be able to have any friends? And probably like, is there any person I can meet of romantic interest in this school? And so I guess I just bring that up because we care a lot about, and we talk a lot about at the beginning of the year, about things that you and I were not thinking about when we were freshmen. Right. And I think we're both assuming, and we tend to assume, that most freshmen coming to college life on their first time are not asking the questions that we are posing, or at least not all of them, or at least it's not the most salient question. And so I guess the question then is posed to us is like, why are you talking about this stuff? You're like, why is this the stuff you're choosing to be sort of the introduction to your ministry, introduction to your community? So we're going to sort of spend the rest of the time talking about that. But let me just, I guess, pose this premise, I think, is that a reason, in my view, why this is the topic of conversation is just who we're talking to is you right now, and also the future you. I sort of can see both of you at the same time. Like, I can see you now, and I can see who you could be, you know? And I think we care so much about who you're becoming and care so much about that future you, that the conversation that we want to start is like, let's start thinking about that now. And let us tell you what we hope for you when you get to that point. And I have something else to say about that, but if you want to jump in.
Yeah, I feel like we've seen these 4 years unfold for hundreds of people that we care a lot about. And we've seen them unfold well, and we've seen them unfold not as well. And we're kind of looking at your 4 years and asking the question, how could it just be the best possible? You know, one of the things that brain scientists talk about is neuroplasticity. You'll learn about that at some point. But neuroplasticity is, you know, the extent to which your brain can form new pathways and, you know, develop new skills and instantiate new habits. And you're actually in a time of maximal neuroplasticity. These 4 years are not just four, you know, sample years of your life. They're actually four really important developmental years that will set a trajectory. And so thinking about, how do I want to spend these years to set up all the rest of the years, not just like in terms of what degree am I going to get so that I can get a job or go to grad school, but in terms of what sorts of patterns, what sorts of habits, what sorts of relationships do I want to develop that will echo for the next few decades, is something that, you know, if it's not the first thing on your mind when you walk into freshman year, putting yourself in proximity to people who are thinking about that for you is really helpful.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the thing that I continue to feel grateful for is that because we lead a community that's like college life, I think we actually have the freedom to focus on these things. So what I mean by that is that if it's true that many people are like me, and what their most salient expression is right now is that they want to find a place to belong, and they want to find a place that is socially satisfying and as well as like spiritually serious, you know, but that there's a big fear of not being known and not being cared for and not being loved, you know, and so it would make sense that if that was the question that a lot of people were asking, and if that was the state of mind that a lot of people were in, it would make sense to almost target and tailor everything to that purpose at the very beginning to sort of get people in the door, right? And so what I feel grateful for in college life is just it's baked into who we are, that we care for people well and that we love people and that we welcome people well. And it's just sort of what it means. It's in the culture. It's just in the water we drink. And so what that allows us to do is then know that, hey, as you walk through college life, you will be cared for. There will be friendships aplenty for you, which allows us to not have to necessarily, quote unquote, I guess, like program for it, because it's just going to happen. So we actually have the freedom to plan and think about some of this more higher level stuff of like, what trajectory can we see for you? What do we want your 4 years to look like in terms of your formation? Not just where can you belong? Because of course you can belong here. You know, it's just going to happen if you go along. We just are naturally going to have strong relationships and strong friendships and chances to make relational ties that are satisfying and that could last for your whole life.
Yeah. C.S. Lewis has this idea for first and second things that you and I have talked about at some point, where, you know, a lot of times the thing you want is the byproduct of the thing that you should actually pursue. That, like, if you want friendship, pursuing friendship is actually not the best way to do that. You know, pursuing a joint objective with a passionate community generates friendship. It's the second thing. It's the byproduct. It's the full house of going for the Yahtzee. But the Yahtzee is, you know, pursuing spiritual formation with a passionate community. And you know what that generates? Like full houses of friendships, you know? And so I think that one of the things that we've seen kind of back engineering this thing is that the answer to loneliness isn't friendship. The answer to loneliness is, you know, embedding yourself in a formative and passionate community, which generates the friendship of shared purpose.
Yeah. There was a moment this summer for me that sort of put all this in pretty stark reality. And it was, so I mentioned that Christian and Olivia got married and Charlie and Haley got married. Again, if you're new, those names mean nothing to you, but just know that they were, all of those were sort of 4-year college life people, got to know them when they were freshmen and then even beyond a few years past their college experience. And so it's like, they are the people to look at essentially to see, not necessarily does this work, because obviously there's varying degrees, but like if you're in college for 4 years, what kind of person do you become? You know, and so when I got to do their wedding, which is the biggest of honors and the biggest of joys, and to sort of stand there pronouncing these two married as they're joining their lives together. And I know that they've been sort of shaped in a similar way. They've been formed in a similar way. They have similar cares and similar habits that have been shaped, not just through like the teaching and preaching, but just what it means to be in college life and what it feels like to be in college life and what it feels like to be a part of this kind of community. They've dated really well. And I just think like they are set up for the next decades of life and joy together. And it's not just obviously the marriage that's the goal here. That's not, we're not just trying to be a marriage factory. But then you see, it's not just that they met each other, but they, all the other people walking down the aisle are also people that they have lived life with and lived life alongside and been, again, formed in a similar direction. So their bridesmaids and their groomsmen are all, are not all, but a lot of them I've been in college life and have lived this journey with them. And I guess I just think like, yeah, this is sort of why we do this thing, or this is what gets me so excited about this, is that that there are ways you can live this life that could have lasting impact. And it's sort of like in those moments where, yes, you are freshmen now, you know, but we have sort of like these moments in mind, like not just, yes, you're like your graduation as you leave this place, sort of what person are you becoming, but also the joys of getting to see that in action and getting to see it actually take place and bless you and set you up for the next few decades. And something that we say quite a bit is that we hope that your time in college is the best 4 years of your life to date, but we hope to help you do college in a way that sets you up for like the next decades to be even better. That's so right. I thought what we could do is just sort of share a little bit what is involved in that. How does that manifest in what we do and what we think? And so I thought we could both go back and forth about what are some of our like big ideas about what we think about the college experience or just human beings that go into how we do what we do and why we do what we do. And so Stanford, could you like, what would you say is one of your like foundational ideas about this college experience? And even if it's not on people's minds right now, is shaping what we're doing in a big way.
I think that while you're making the decisions in the first, you know, couple of weeks of college, I think there's just one sociological fact that you want to keep in mind. And that is that you become the product of the communities in which you embed yourself in.
Yeah.
You become your communities. And this is a little bit counterintuitive, because I think that, less so now, but I think that we are in kind of Western culture, we're still kind of wrapped around the axle of this Enlightenment myth of the rational individual.
Yeah.
A lot of good things happen in the Enlightenment, but also a lot of just like epistemological mischief happened in the Enlightenment.
Why don't you define epistemological real fast?
Epistemology is just the branch of philosophy where we talk about, you know, how do you know what's true? How do you think about what's real? And in the Enlightenment, there was this idea that humans are basically rational actors, that we're basically computers in a meat suit. We make these rational choices. And so a lot of times you hear this in the church too. You hear us talk about, you know, moral formation and, you know, moral choices in terms of choices. You're going to make a string of choices. And at the end of your life, you're going to kind of be the sum of these choices, but you're a rational mm-hmm. actor making these individual choices. And that is just psychologically and sociologically naive. It's not the way humans act. Humans are not a single man making a series of individual choices. That was gendered because it was a callback to your movie. A single person.
Yeah, single man. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Making a string of individual choices. We are embedded in communities, and we tend to act out of the plausibility structures and the joint cultural agreements of those communities that we embed ourselves in. And so there's a sense in which we don't have a lot of autonomy over individual decisions. We don't make single choices very well. This is not what we as critters do. We tend to have trajectory and momentum based on the joint values of the communities we embed ourselves in. And so I think that in general, we underrate the extent to which the network of relationships around us affect our individual choices. And that, you know, that can just feel like bad news, because it can feel like, well, I don't want to admit that I make choices out of like the pressure of the community I'm in or something like that. Like, I just think that I'm like mentally stronger than that. And, you know, that's fine, but it's just not true. We are kind of a constellation of the values of the communities that we embed ourselves in, and we make contributions to those communities. But that's really one of the basic sociological facts and spiritual facts, is that, you know, we are social creatures. And so does that mean that your life is just kind of an accident of the communities that you belong to? Well, no, you do have a choice in what communities form your values. You get to choose which communities you embed yourself in. Now, a lot of the college experience, it is this kind of haphazard bouncing between communities until you find one that you fit into. And you could find yourself at the end of college having belonged to a series of communities that were just kind of accidentally discovered. Or you could find and then you would kind of be the sum of the values of those communities. Or you could start with your freshman year and kind of reverse engineer who you want to be. You can ask yourself, who do I want to be at the end of these 4 years? You mentioned I'm a scientist and an engineer. And so I think a lot about like, what result do we want and how do I reverse engineer that result? Who do you want to be at the end of 4 years? And then we can, you know, just kind of say the best way to become that person is to embed yourself in communities that are made up of those kinds of people.
Yeah. So let me see if I can trace some things that you said. So you're essentially saying that this idea that we become who we're going to become based on our individual choices at any given time, like that we are basically the sum of our choices, is a little bit naive, that actually we're probably more of the sum of our communities and the values of our communities. And that can sound like sort of bad news, because it sounds almost like determinism, and it's not determinism. What it is it's saying that your communities, who you are around and who you probably subtext in that is who you think is cool and who you want to be like, have an outsized impact on who you become. And so you actually do have a very important choice in this. And the very important choice is who are you going to surround yourself with, because a lot of the other choices are going to happen automatically.
That's right. One of the major things that's emerged from brain science in the last 20 years is the massive amount of our life that is subconscious or on autopilot. And right. That's not bad news, because, you know, that stuff's expensive for the brain to process.
Right.
And so it's really actually great that most of what we do happens on autopilot. But the way that you take control of how that part of your life happens is to make explicit choices to engineer your environment so that you train that portion of yourself to act in ways that you would want it to act. And the church for millennia has called that process spiritual formation.
Right.
And, you know, whether we want to put the word spiritual at the front end of it or not, humans go through a period of training their subconscious that we call formation. You're forming your habits, you're forming your values. And a lot of that happens implicitly. And most of it happens in the context of the communities that you live in. And so you do have a choice. You have a choice of which communities are going to form you.
Yeah. And sorry, something you just said is just so interesting to me. But this idea that your habits are being formed, and in the church, we've talked about that as being spiritual formation. And you can drop spiritual if you want, it could be formation. And I think almost you can sort of hear that as like, oh, okay, well, the really mature people will be formed and the immature people will not be formed. But what we're saying is that no matter what, formation is happening. You are being formed in a direction, and there are ways that formation, again, can. And that, I guess that's what we mean when we, like, even the marriage example. It's like, these are, again, it's not the marriage per se that I'm saying that is the the product of formation, but it's like these two people who are ready to commit themselves to each other and have been formed in the same direction. They see the world in a similar way. They have similar values and they're coming together to join a life, you know, like it's like that didn't happen by accident. And also something happened, like they were formed along the way to become that. And it wasn't just a blank state that they just happened to become who they became. You know, it was a choice, and maybe they weren't always aware of the choices they were making, but along the way they were being formed in a direction. And do you have an example of what that looks like? What it means to be like, what is the practical outworking of what it looks like to be formed by a community in a certain way, and maybe even sort of without knowing it?
Well, I mean, let's start with, you know, the academic example that, you know, actually UC Davis has a plan for your formation. Actually, UC Davis doesn't, but your academic department does. If you are an engineering student, the engineering department has a plan for your formation as an engineer. You know, I had a professor who, one of my favorite professors, my graduate advisor in my first graduate degree, he showed up the first day and he said, you know, you are paying for this, so you might think you're a customer, but you are not a customer. You are a product. We are making you into an engineer. And so, you know, you know, and I think that that's the way a good academic department thinks. They think about what are the habits and the skills that this person needs in order to be able to operate in the world in this discipline. And so that's why, even though the problem set might not seem like it's related to your future job, that's why English majors do the reading, you know, like yeah. Even if it seems like this isn't something you're excited about, is because it's not about the content. It's about the process of formation. And so your academic department has a plan for who they want you to be in 4 years to release you into this vocational world. And it's actually pretty dialed in. You know, they're really good at that. But that's only one aspect of your life, right? UC Davis doesn't have a plan for your like moral formation. That's not part of their job description. You're going to also need to choose a Christian community who is going to help form you into a person who's going to have a lifelong conversation with God, who's going to be a contributing member of a church, who's going to be able to navigate some of the like unbelievably difficult moral questions that things like, you know, AI and genetic engineering are going to pose to you in the next 40 years. You know, like yeah. Those are the sorts of things that you're going to want to have trajectory of right. growth towards.
Right. I feel like what you're saying about what happens to people in communities, that is just like deep into me and like how I think and how I see the world. And this is the type of thing that when I'm at like a dinner party or like when I hear when I'm in like a conversation with people, like at a family function or something like that, like I'm always thinking about these things. Like I'm always thinking about like, well, how is what you're saying influenced by X, Y, or Z? Like, or who are you being shaped by? Or who are you being formed by to say this or that? Or trying to think about my own self, like, why do I think this? Like, who's telling me this, you know? And so it is just, it's not sort of a quote unquote ministry strategy because it's what necessarily gets most people through the door. It's just, this is just how sort of we see the world, and like how we're convinced that human being that God has made human beings to work, essentially. And so it's just built into what we do. But so here's the thing. So you talked about how we sort of become our communities. And I think the nuance I would like to put on that is that we become what our communities value and what our communities are sort of quote unquote all about. And so there's this passage in John, in the beginning of John, where there's these two followers of Jesus who get really excited that they see Jesus and they're following after him. And Jesus turns around and says to them, I think the first thing he says, that might be the first thing he says in the whole Gospel of John, he says, "What do you want?" And obviously, that could just be, hey, what do you want to eat or drink? Or what's, you know, what's your, what do you want right now? But I think we're safe to think that that's a more profound question of sort of what do you want? And that being a very deep question for their life and their experience. And I think what he's getting at, without much time to prove it, is that sort of what is driving your life, the engine of your life, is what is that what you want the most? And so it's, he didn't ask, what do you think? He didn't ask, what do you know? He didn't ask, what you believe? Because those things are all very important parts of our self and our being, but they are not the engine that's driving everything that we're doing. So like, I believe that maybe like climate change is bad, you know, but and that's something I feel like I know, and it's something I believe, but it is not the engine driving my life. It is not the primary thing that's motivating all of my behavior. And so sort of an example of this that we've talked about last year in college life is there's that scene in Harry Potter, or multiple scenes, I guess, with the Mirror of Erised, where you look at this mirror and it shows you what your heart desires. You know, it doesn't show you what you think you desire. It doesn't show you what you tell people you desire or what you want. It shows you what you actually desire. And sort of, again, the subtext of that is it's possible for you to not know what is most precious to you. And it's possible for you to not know what you desire the most in the whole world. And then the argument is that that thing is actually the thing driving your behavior and pushing you forward and thrusting you into whatever you're doing. And it's the thing animating everything that you're doing. And so, again, sort of trying to pull all these threads together is that that thing that you see when you look in the mirror of Erised, that thing you desire the most, you do have a choice of what that is, but you're not always consciously choosing that thing. I think what we're saying is that often, because you become your communities, what actually happens is that you start to value and want and desire those things in your communities that are that they want and desire, or that they're built around. And so this is a pejorative example, and I'm sure I will misspeak, but you know, there are communities in this university that are more into things like alcohol and sex and partying and just about this sort of moment, just about maximizing pleasure now, I guess. I don't know if that might not be exactly the right thing to say, but and so you might hear us saying is like, oh, when we're saying that the habits that you're choosing are dictating who you're becoming, it's not necessarily the actual acts of, you know, the sex or the alcohol or the partying or whatever. It's more like, what is behind that? What is the object of desire? What desire is behind those habits? And like, that is sort of what is we're saying, or I think I'm saying, what is forming you and what is shaping you. And that is what's driving your, that's what's driving who you're becoming. That the idea that you are becoming more of that which you desire most. And so the sort of spiritual religious word for that, of like that deep desire, is worship. That you are becoming more like what you worship. And sort of that word worship, again, has spiritual overtones, obviously, but really what it means is to spend your life serving, you know, to spend your life in service or pursuit or deepest affection of that thing, you know? And so the argument would be that everyone is worshiping something. And so there's this David Foster Wallace quote. He gave this commencement address, that it's a pretty famous commencement address at Kenyon College, where he was a teacher and our professor. And he says that here's something that's weird, but true. He says, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism, because there's no such thing as not worshiping. He says, everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it JC or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some inviolable set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. It's good. Worship power and you will end up feeling weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to numb yourself to your own fear. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you'll end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. And so, you know, David Foster Wallace is not a Christian person. He doesn't share this worldview that true life is found in worshiping the King Jesus, you know, but he's saying that every one of us is worshiping something. And what he's saying is what you worship does something to you. It changes you. It forms you. You're becoming more like that thing that you worship. And so, again, to try to pull all the threads together, you want to embed yourself in a community that is essentially trying to worship that which is actually going to give you life. And there are many things you can worship that are going to take life from you, that are not going to be life-giving to you. And so you want to, in order to sort of experience life and true life and life at its full, you want to be embedding yourself in a community that is going in a direction that is going to give you life and not take life from you. And sort of what we're saying is, a lot of that is going to happen subconsciously. You're not always going to be aware of how these things that are the values of a community are forming you or shaping you. It's just true that they are. And so there's a sense in which you can make a very good decision about putting yourself in a community that is going towards a life-giving trajectory. And then you can sort of be on the ride. Anyway, do you feel like the threads were pulled together enough? You know, it's sort of a complex I don't know if it's a complex argument, but it's anyway, now I'm rambling. But anything you could say to it?
Okay, so at this point, it can seem like we make a very sophisticated psychological and theological case for a very simple action. You need to join a Christian community. Who you become in 4 years will be correlated mostly to, do you join and commit to a Christian community in the first 3 to 5 weeks of college? And, you know, we've seen people who've done this differently. We've seen people who have kind of, you know, wandered for their first year and then come in their sophomore year. And you know what they feel? Regret. You know, like they have an excellent experience, but like really the psychology, the sociology, and the theology all point to the same thing, that, you know, there are going to be a lot of things that happen to you and around you over the course of the next 4 years that's going to have a disproportional effect on what your life is going to be like when you're my age, right? The number one thing that you can do to help you process that is to embed yourself in a community of people who are trying to follow Jesus and who are really serious about the intellectual life and about growing in vocation, and, you know, aren't disdainful of the university task that they're taking on, but also, you know, trying to grow not only as a worker in the world and someone who's going to be able to get a job and someone who's growing intellectually, but someone who's also like really taking charge of how they're growing emotionally and psychologically and, you know, in their body and spiritually. How are they aligning their lives with the reality of a world created and sustained by God? So I think that, you know, I've said this a number of times. I think that the takeaway of over a decade of campus ministry is, if you spend these 4 years kind of at the margins of Christian community, you're just kind of ripping yourself off of, you know, not only one of the most fun things that's available on the UC Davis campus, but also like a real opportunity to embed yourself in a community that's going to give you trajectory with habits and practices that will, you know, help you become the kind of person you want to be.
Yeah. And I don't know how much we will have said this at this point, but there's lots of things to care about in terms of trajectory. And we care more about these three things, but three things that we've boiled down a little bit is that if we could help students learn, know and love the scriptures, so like actually feel like they have a better understanding of them, but also learning to love the scriptures, they'll be set up for a lifelong relationship with Jesus. If we could help them learn to love the local church with all of its misgivings, with all of its failures, and with all of its ways it has not lived up to its vocation, it is the chosen vessel of God to bring salt and light to the world. And to live this life, you're going to have to learn to love the local church. And so we hope to do that. And we hope to give students an opportunity to make the best friends of their life, which is not some just fun add-on. We just know profoundly and deeply that the Christian life does not happen outside of community. And so we care a lot about the kind of community that's being formed. And so that animates a lot of what we do. We do different retreats to center on those things. We do different teachings to center on those things and things that are built on not just how are you living life right now, but who are you becoming?
Yeah. In addition to that, I would say to folks who are coming on campus, we also care about your questions and your doubts. And you'll probably encounter some new and challenging material in the next, you know, few quarters. And you might wonder how that integrates into the Christian faith. And but, you know, that's really central to what we try to do over the course of these 4 years. We don't run away from doubts. You know, we're not a skeptical community, but we're a curious community. We're really curious about how it works together. You know, we're not afraid of facts. And so we are going to take on some of the difficult questions over the course of your 4 years here. And we would love to, you know, process those in individual conversation at the Coho when that is possible, maybe with masks. But also, like, we'll do that kind of as a community as well. So if you encounter things that seem challenging, you know, those are opportunities to grow.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're excited about those conversations. That gets us going. So those are exciting conversations. And so is this exciting conversation. What we're going to do now is jump into what we call Quarantine Corner. And it's how we end every episode of the podcast. And essentially what we're trying to do is, you know, we're in quarantine, not able to do as much as we used to do. And so we want to help people know how to navigate their time. in quarantine. And so we, each of us are going to give a little recommendation about what to do in quarantine to whatever, give you joy, give you life. And so Stanford, I'm going to let you choose your own adventure for my quarantine corner, because I'm realizing that the older Mason, my son, gets, the more my quarantine corners are more sort of dad centric, which is more not applicable to our students than ever. But it's also, you know, the way I'm living my life. And so I would like to offer you, I have two potential quarantine corners, and I would like for you to choose your own adventure. Would you like the more dad centered one or the less dad centered one?
Okay, so you know that I would choose the more dad centric one, because it's one of the central, like, animated questions in my life. But trying to be more contextual, let me choose the less dad centric one, and then I want the other one off air.
Okay, yeah. I'll be honest that this one is relatively tame, but it is giving me immense amounts of joy. I have started to radically bump up when I get ready for bed. Okay, so my quarantine corner is get ready for bed, like, well before you're going to bed.
Interesting.
That's my new quarantine corner. So, like, whatever your routine is for getting to bed, like, brush your teeth, floss your teeth. I write down my favorite part of the day in a little planner at the end of the day. So I used to do that right before bed, and now I'm just doing it all. You know, we've been watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, you know, before sleep time, and so as that episode's going, I'm flossing and I'm brushing, and I get my little notepad out and I make my little notes. And then when I actually want to go to bed, the only step is to walk into the room and go to sleep. That's the only thing left to do, because there's nothing worse than being super tired and having to do all of that. Because sometimes you just want to go to bed and you don't want to do any of those things. So maybe you'll risk having bad dental hygiene. But the real problem is that sometimes you're super tired and then you go do those things and now you're like awake again. And you're not, like, you don't feel as ready for bed. That's what happens to me. And so now if you just front load all that, do all that stuff while you're doing fun things, then when it's time to actually go to bed, you just go to bed. And it is the freedom that I can't even describe to you, the freedom I feel when I'm fully ready for bed and I haven't gone to bed yet. And it's like, there's still some of the night left. It is radical amounts of joy. And so it's a small thing, but it will improve your day. You're going to feel good about yourself.
Yeah, I have to say that that's not even remotely anywhere near my practice, but I'm intrigued.
You got to do it. You got the feeling of being ready, and all you have to do is go into bed is, like, so glorious.
Yeah, I've been going to bed earlier. That is something I've been doing.
Well, I think it's like the inverse of getting up super early. So, like, I've become an early riser, which makes you feel like you're winning the day. Like, when you're up before the sun's up and you just know,
welcome,
like, no
my
one.
Friend.
Yeah. Well, you just know, like, it feels like I am beating everybody else in the day. I'm winning right now. And I feel like it's that feeling at the end of the night. It's like, it feels like I'm gaining time. Like, I'm just putting it in my pocket for future use. All right. What's yours?
Okay. So my quarantine corner is my favorite fun reading genre, as we've covered on this podcast before, is hard science fiction. And my favorite author is Ted Chiang. He's a short fiction author. There was a movie, Arrival, that was based on my absolute favorite short story called Stories of Your Life. But he has a new novel out, a new collection of short stories. Yeah. And so I banged through it. It's delightful. He is kind of really animated by the question of determinism or free will from a secular point of view. And so the whole series of short stories is this, you know, interrogation in narrative space of, you know, to what extent are we free moral agents, and to what extent are we formed by our communities or formed by things like language or things like that. So he's in an idea space that I find very interesting. But I can tell you that I recommended my quarantine corner to my children, even though there's no chance they'll take it up, because my oldest asked me at dinner 3 days ago if I believed in the multiverse, if I believed that there were parallel realities.
Like Spider-Man? Spider-Verse?
Kind of like Spider-Man, yeah, right. But, you know, if there are quantum events that create multiple realities, and I don't know. I'm agnostic with respect to the multiverse. I've seen the math. You know, I understand why people believe in it. But Ted Chiang has a story called Anxiety is the Dizziness of Freedom in his new short story compilation. But the Anxiety is the Dizziness of Freedom is based on this, you know, speculative technology where when timelines split, there's a communication device that allows them to keep track of each other. So people can correspond with the versions of themselves across timelines. And what he's interested in is the philosophical idea of to what extent are we making free choices? To what extent are our choices determined? To what extent is just random weather patterns affecting our realities? And it is a really powerful story.
That's awesome. I appreciate your commitment to the genre. I appreciate your commitment to elevating the literacy of Quarantine Corner. And I remember reading the Stories of Us based on your recommendation and finding it delightful. And so I'm sure this is a joy as well. Well, thank you, Stanford. Thanks for hopping on and having this convo with me. I think we'll see each other next week for another conversation.
That's right. It's good to be back. And we'll pick this up next week with a little bit of comparative historiography between the current moment and the year 78.
That's right. And if that doesn't excite you, you need some excitement medicine. All right, that is it for the podcast. I hope that this conversation has been helpful, and I genuinely hope that even if college life is not the community you intentionally intend to embed yourself into, that this conversation has helped you think more seriously about whichever one is going to be blessed with your presence. And I want to say thank you to Stanford for waking up early to talk with me and for the years of affection and attention that you've given to this community and to me. Thank you, as always, to Kyle Jung and Josh Paskey for the music of Your Pod and Your Staff. I believe it is hip to say that it is a bop. And thank you to College Life alum and current friend Heidi Rudvoets for taking the gargantuan task of editing these podcasts. You are now my best friend, Heidi. And I want to say thank you to the new ears who are listening in on this conversation. It really is so good to talk to you. And again, I hope very much to get to hear your voice soon as well. And please go to our website, collegelifedavis.com, to find out all you need to know about College Life. And download our app, College Life UCD, on the App Store or Google Play. And you can even listen to this podcast straight from the app. Who knew? And so to close, College Life, know this. We love you more than the total number of pages in Stanford's big bag of Bibles. We'll see you on Zoom, and we'll see you next week.